Now, before we get into today's episode, I just want to give you a heads up that we're going to be talking about eating disorders in some detail. So if you're somebody who feels like you might not want to listen to this right now, you can hit pause, come back to it anytime. Just wanted to let you know about that. Hello and welcome to The Doctor Will Hear You Now, the podcast hosted by me, Dr. Zoe Williams. Now, I'm a practicing GP and medical professional, but in this podcast series, I'm not the expert. In The Doctor Will Hear You Now, I'm here to learn from you. Each episode, I'll face a health condition which is riddled with stigma and misinformation. By passing the microphone, literally, to a well-known name, join me as I learn their story. Plus, with the help of our wonderful series sponsor, Bupa, we'll be joined a bit later on in each episode by someone who has a lot of experience in the subject matter. Together, we'll leave each episode with a greater understanding. This is The Doctor Will Hear You Now. Today's guest, for the first time, I've invited a fellow doctor onto the podcast, and you'll know this person very well because he's been a staple on our screen since 2018, and he's going to be talking not about medicine, we'll talk about that a little bit, but more about him himself, and we'll get to know the man behind the white coat. And I keep talking about white coats, but as doctors, we don't wear them anymore. I never wore one. So yeah, it is a pleasure to invite Alex on. He is a fellow doctor, but when it comes to doctors, to me, he's one of the real good guys, because he's gone way and beyond, above and beyond, and the work that he's doing in this country to support all of our mental health. I think I'd love to talk to you a little bit about that, but mostly for today we're going to be talking about body image and eating disorders, and you're going to share your experience personally with that with us as well. So the first question I'd love to ask you is, what is the one thing you should never say to somebody who is having issues with body image or who is experiencing an eating disorder?
I think one of the most important things I've heard from young people, particularly traveling the country, you know, in my role as mental health ambassador, and actually in most of the campaign and the work that I do, I try and speak to as many people as I can. These are from experts and parents and teachers, but also meeting young people. And we know that eating disorders are massively on the rise amongst the younger generation, frighteningly so, I would say. And speaking to young people, it's pretty clear that a lot of the time there's a feeling that they are not seen when it comes to experiencing eating disorders, especially in the early days, and often that their first interactions or opening up around eating disorder often ends up being almost a dismissal of what they feel. So a good example is that I think as humans, not just as doctors, but also as parents, as teachers, as friends, as family members, we want to fix. As humans, we're problem solvers. So if someone presents the problem and says, look, I feel like I just hate my body, I feel overweight, I look awful, and you're saying all these things, often the reaction maybe as a parent might be, I think you're beautiful, you look gorgeous. And that is the opinion of that parent. The parent is sharing what they feel. And the slight problem there can be is that there is an immediate separation between I feel my feelings are valid and this is how I feel about my body and you don't understand. And this is something I've heard time and time again from traveling up to Scotland, across to Wales and many parts of England, schools and things. It is a common thing that I hear. And I think, you know, one bit of advice that I was given both by parents and also from those in recovery from eating disorders is just try and be a friend, don't fix, when it comes to eating disorders. So if someone comes to you and says, look, I feel this, then just saying, look, I don't necessarily understand everything you're saying, but I'm here for you and together let's work it out. What does getting better look like to you? And often then that frames things, that you're not sat in front of someone like, I'm going to fix you. You're like on the shoulder.
Yeah.
Because even as a doctor, and I mean, you must have this as well, where people kind of go, oh, can I ask you this, or can you look at this, or what do you think I should do with this? Unless you're seeing someone in a clinical perspective, you're not there to be the doctor, are you? Even if you're a psychiatrist, if you've got a child, it might be tempting to bring your psychiatry home, but then you risk doing the same thing of creating that separation.
Yeah.
It's just thinking like, what's my role in this scenario, I guess. And that, I love that phrase I was told, be a friend, don't fix.
Yeah. And it's sometimes, I think, especially, I guess, as a parent, it's allowing yourself to feel that vulnerability and discomfort of actually not fixing. And, you know, this is a problem that I can't fix, but it's a problem that I want you to be able to share with me. Yeah. It's the art of listening, isn't it? It's the art of actually turning, as doctors, it's something that we do all the time. And as parents, we come up with the solutions, and it's
putting that to one side, not coming up with solutions and just really listening.
It kind of reminds me, this is completely different and I'm not making comparisons, but recently, about 8 months ago, I was diagnosed with ADHD, which is something that is quite topical in the news at the moment. And I first said to my parents about a year ago and said, look, I've kind of thought a lot of my life that I might have ADHD. It's something I just really like to understand about myself. And they were really, and I think they're happy for me to say this, they were kind of really uncomfortable about the whole thing. They first like, don't be silly, you don't have it. And there was quite a lot of, I think it brought up a feeling of almost offensiveness because there was a feeling of, well, if you do, we've missed it and we didn't, we failed in that sense. And
Fear of the failure.
Even when I said to them, look, I've been diagnosed now, this is, and I understand myself so much better. It took a while for them to be okay with that. I had to kind of say, look, there's no judgment on you. Like, I don't think that there was, I don't think anyone really understood what ADHD was, or a lot of people don't understand what it is even now, let alone when I was growing up. Like, don't take it as you've not failed. It's not about people failing. And sometimes we can make the situation worse. You know, and I was aware that that was the issue for them, but it could have made an actual quite distance between us, because it's like, oh, well, you're invalidating the fact to have ADHD. But that's, of course, not what was happening. They just found it hard for themselves as well.
I think, you know, one of the things on this podcast, we particularly aim to cover topics where there is still a lot of stigma and there is still sometimes a lot of shame as well. And I think with mental health conditions, if you were able to just zap stigma and shame so it didn't exist anymore, then, you know, it would make life so much easier for people to talk about what they're going through, to share their experiences, and perhaps, you know, actually within their relationships, such as whether it is a parent-child relationship, a partner, even teachers, you know, at school, it makes those conversations easier, and it makes it makes life easier.
You've been working across this kind of space for such a long time, and obviously with the work that you do, you must see it in your work that the barriers to actually getting better in whatever field it might be, that might be towards eating disorders, it might be towards other conditions, it does feel that so much like the actual barrier of stigma is an invisible one, but it's incredibly powerful, certainly for certain groups depending on the conversation. I guess it's something you've seen for a long time. It just shocks me still, even now it still shocks me how much it affects people.
Well, I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask was, as someone who's, you know, younger than me and been to medical school a few years later than me, was about your experience and your training when it came to eating disorders and body image, to see if it was similar to mine. Yeah. Because I think, you know, if we're really, really honest, even amongst doctors, amongst GPs, I think when it comes to eating disorders, I think we still kind of have this case study, the case study that I was taught at medical school, I was taught to. There was the anorexia case and there was the bulimia case. And it was that, you know, very, very stereotypical. Usually it would be a young female who's struggling with exams. So it would be not only the person would be stereotypical, but the presentation would be very stereotypical. And we know that eating disorders are much broader than that. There are many different types that affect any person of any age, of any gender, and it can affect them differently. And, you know, having an eating disorder, it's not just people with a certain body type or body shape either. You can be any size and have an eating disorder. How was your medical training in this area?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of laughed at it almost because I thought, you know, it just reminded me that as you're speaking, we were basically taught that it was a person with a low BMI that was usually a girl. And I'm pretty sure it was a student of some sort that couldn't cope. And that was the...
Usually a very, you know, a straight A student as well.
Yeah, it was kind of a very stereotypical case. And it's quite unhelpful because then we picture certain things to look that way. And it kind of, and I'm drawing comparisons because again, with, you know, one of the things that I heard a lot of was, well, when you grew up, you weren't bouncing around the room. You weren't jumping around. How could you have ADHD? Well, less than 10% of people with ADHD have external hyperactivity. Yeah. You know, if we build the problem with stereotypes is that they can be helpful to have an example of how something looks. But if that becomes like a diagnostic criteria, almost like a, you're either like this or you don't have it, and that's where the real issue is. And one of the things that is not spoken enough about is how much eating disorders affect men. I think we have an idea that it just affects women, and that's not the case. We do know that in terms of diagnosis, there's multiple times more diagnosis of women each year than, or girls or boys, women or men, each year than men, but that doesn't mean there's not a significant number of men. And also I think the thing is, what's interesting is that in men, it can often present differently, of course, as well. It might be that someone has got a six pack and big muscles and looks, you know, in terms of what society would view as
healthy.
That's healthy. Yeah. But as you exactly said, it's not about the BMI. Like obviously there are, you know, with extremes of BMI, there are health things associated with that, but the disorder itself is not about the BMI, and it's not about whether you have a six pack or not. It's about the relationship with the food, the behavior, the way that we view ourselves and the way that we treat our own body and weaponize food potentially even. So, yeah. You know, that kind of idea of, the six-pack guy that's got big muscles, really healthy. Well, actually, you know, he could have a very unhealthy relationship with food, over-exercising, over-training. He might even be using substances such as steroids too, which is of serious health consequences potentially to achieve those goals. And that is as much as an eating disorder as what we learned at med school to be like a typical eating disorder. And I think it is a problem because then the people that are healthcare professionals, we have this view of what it is. And it's really hard if you don't have a broader view of what actually lies behind that for you to actually recognize it in your own lives as well as and in yourself actually as well as with other people. I've definitely had times where I think around Love Island stuff, if I look at the behavior I had around food running up to that, it was entirely unhealthy and toxic. You know, I was like, right, science, I need protein, I need some carbs to exercise, I need some vegetables, but I'm going to limit food to its macro and I'm going to measure the food to the gram to exactly what I need to achieve this aesthetic. I stopped eating. I would never have a cake in a coffee shop. I wouldn't probably go to the coffee shop with friends to remove the risk of that. So I isolated myself.
Social behaviours were changing.
The impact, my social behaviours, you look at the kind of, I guess, indicators that something is really developing as a problem. I mean, you could argue that I had an outcome as in a date that I was going on to a show and therefore I was therefore working towards that. But it doesn't mean that the behaviours weren't incredibly unhealthy. But I noticed actually by the end of that how obsessive I had become over it. And there was a real time of like, wow, that's kind of, that really scared me in a way. And after the show, I was like, I don't want to go back to that because actually I was isolated. My mood was not in a good place. And I had a six pack and all that kind of stuff. But I would not say in any way that I was healthy.
And, you know, that's why when we're talking about eating disorders and, you know, the things around body image, is very much, it is a mental health condition, you know, the physical health aspects are the sort of the side effects, the symptoms, what can come from it, but it really is a mental health condition. I wanted to ask you, before you went on Love Island, had you had much of a concern or had you thought much about your body in the aesthetic sense in terms of what other people would think about your body prior to that? Or was that the first time you'd really considered it?
So it's interesting. I think there's a big conversation about masculinity at the moment, an important conversation, and what it means to be masculine and how we define that. And then therefore, what does toxic masculinity look like? And when I was growing up, I lived in West Wales and I was surrounded by rugby and sport. And I guess the idea of being a man in West Wales is like big and strong playing rugby. And I was quite a skinny teenager. So I trained so hard and used protein shakes from a young age and I was trying to get to this certain size. And really that was an unhealthy metric because I was really thinking like, I want to be really, really big.
Yeah.
I want to look a certain way. And I looked around and it was pretty commonplace. Everyone was very similar with that. And we know that actually in parts of South, particularly West Wales, there are issues with things like steroid use. I saw a lot of steroid use at school and growing up. I've never used steroids personally and I hand on heart can say that, but it was, I could have done very easily.
Yeah.
Did use a lot of protein shakes and stuff, which is fine. There's nothing against using protein shakes, but I think it was, again, it's behind that that was the issue. But then I kind of went to uni and at med school, I was kind of like, I don't feel this is as important anymore. I just want to exercise and I don't need to try and be big or whatever. But then, it cropped up again at the kind of that Love Island, I guess, stage. But it's interesting. Those are the times I think I was felt kind of pressures to look that way. But then I think there have been other times where relationship with food have been unhealthy. And I think up till probably last summer, I was overeating. I mean, it's a separate conversation. I'm not going to not diagnose an eating disorder. I'm not going to self-diagnose. It clearly would be against the rule book, but I can certainly see that there were behaviors that were unhealthy around my eating and stress. So I was overeating. I went through a difficult time in a relationship. I went through losing my brother a couple of years ago. And I think I turned to food for comfort.
Yeah.
And I think I recognized that at the end of last summer that had become unhealthy. And again, I think it's sometimes realizing like, why am I doing this? So again, there's a bit of a step back and thought, well, there's a lot of traumas I haven't dealt with, probably using it for comfort. Maybe there's the mental health side that I need to deal with. And as I've dealt with that, my relationship again is like recentered. I cook and I enjoy eating for the pleasure of food, but also for the health of food. I exercise regularly. And, you know, I don't know what I weigh, but I've probably lost quite a few stone. I'd say probably, you know, a reasonable amount of weight since last summer. And I never measured myself at the start point, i.e. at my heaviest, and I don't know what I weigh now. And I think that's really important because then that's where I think you can start creating this kind of almost competition of the weight. I really deliberately try to focus on, what's behind this? Like, if I'm, why am I behaving this way? Rather than thinking of the outcome. I mean, when people say, oh, Alex, you've lost weight, and you know, that's fine. But it's important not to make it about like losing weight seems a necessarily good thing. It might be a really bad thing, actually. Mm. And I think in general, it's best just not to comment on people's weights.
Yes, you know,
I agree. Over recent years, I've just learned, just don't say anything.
I think actually anything about a person's appearance, I think these days, isn't
anything.
It? Just don't, unless you're asked.
You look beautiful. I like your dress. I think it's the things that suggest that perhaps before that you didn't. And I think it may well be true. It may well have been that I did look unhealthy at that time. That might be true. That might not be connected to my weight. But it's not for other people to choose that. It's for yourself. And again,
absolutely.
That doesn't fix the internal stuff that you get involved in that dialogue. And I think that's the thing that's worth it. And that's another reason why I think the learning around it's important, because then we stop learning that the symptom or what you're seeing on the outside, we stop learning as that as the outcome and almost think the outcome is actually improving what's going on here and everything else will follow.
Thank you for sharing all of that. I think, you know, people will take a lot away from that. I think the most important thing perhaps is to all of us to just think before you speak and comment on somebody's appearance. But what was interesting in what you were saying there as a woman, having grown up when I have, and, you know, we talk all the time about almost how our brains have been polluted because we've been brought up with what is meant to be a healthy body or a beautiful body or, you know, what that aesthetic is. I think that's the first time actually I've heard a man talk about not just their own experience, but talk about like a whole community of people that you were growing up with in West Wales who were celebrating this particular body ideal, which is partly influenced by rugby, the rugby culture and the sport culture, and how therefore steroid use was so common and so easy to come by. I think that's the first time I've heard somebody talk about that.
I think it's an example of toxic masculinity, whereby the idea of masculinity is such that if you're not in that place, then you need to do whatever you can to achieve that. I'd say out of my six closest friends, probably four of them were using or had used at some point steroids. And I still know people in my life that I grew up with that still use it because there's still a lot of that kind of culture. And I'm very passionate around the point of like thinking about what masculinity means for several reasons, one of which I think it's really important. I don't think anyone wants to get rid of masculinity. I think men and young boys need to have an identity for them to aim for. But I think it's readdressing it. I mean, when I grew up, the idea of sharing weakness, of not being a leader, of showing emotion and these kind of things, these were emasculating things. Whereas now my idea of masculinity can be, you can follow female leadership, you can show weakness and be strong. You know, that basically the idea that you can be someone that shares a range of your emotions and is able to kind of admit when they need help and stuff and still be masculine.
We're learning more now, aren't we? And I think understanding more and the message is getting out there that actually being brave enough to be vulnerable and show emotion, I think we're getting to a point where that is now starting to be celebrated, and the word brave and vulnerability being put into the same
sentence. It's a sign of strength. I mean, I like the analogy that, you know, stoicism and perhaps the idea of being a masculine man in the past was, you know, bullets bounce off me and I'm so strong and I'm resilient to everything, you know, pressure, I don't, you know, succumb to pressure. But we know that if you're not able to be flexible and be able to flow with and learn when to adapt, then actually if you put enough pressure, you'll break, almost like a branch on a tree. Whereas what you want happens, you can bend and flex.
Yeah.
And return to your original state. And I think for me then, therefore, the idea of like strength and resilience is actually being able to recognize when you're under pressure, understand how to adapt, know who to turn to, you know. And I think I've got better with that as years gone by. Like, well, I've gone through difficult times. I pick up my mom, I've got a best friend I talk to. I have my emergency toolkit, which is partly made up of you know, certain self-care things that I know are just like really, really ground me and give me that grounding. But also in the emergency toolkit is, who am I going to call? You know, it's not the Ghostbusters. it's my mum or my best friend, Adam. I mean, those are the people that I hear their voice. There's almost a grounding even from hearing from them, knowing, right, I'm in a safe space.
Yeah,
here.
You're safe.
You know, and you can be a man and be vulnerable and share and be really strong.
Well, you know, the way you speak now, it's really clear that whilst you've had some really difficult times and that has impacted on your eating behaviors to some extent, you now, by understanding the psychology behind that, you may be way further ahead than a lot of us are because you understand the psychology. How did you get to the point where you really understood that? Going back to Love Island, when was maybe, you know, you were eating a certain way, like you said, you were calorie counting and all the rest of it for this aesthetic, to now you sit there as somebody who seems like you really understand the psychology and the science of yourself. Does that mean, do you think you'll have any further issues in the future? And how did you get to that place of such,
I think life is all a bit about learning, isn't it? And you learn a lot either from things that you you know, you ask questions or you get taught things externally or you learn from your own experiences. And I guess I recognized the time when I was, you know, out in my makeshift gym, training really hard, overtraining, getting angry when I wasn't getting as big as quickly as I wanted to. I recognized being like, oh, that was quite unhealthy as a 15-year-old. I also look at the time at 27 where I was like under pressure.
Yeah.
I felt under pressure to look a certain way on the show. I recognize those times, but also recognize, yeah, times in my life where I've used food as a coping mechanism and through, you know, I wouldn't say hugely through med school, to be honest. I think we'd probably agree on that. But through my own kind of experience, my learning through therapy, through even through my master's now in mental health, I'm learning a lot through that. And also through wider conversations, things like having this podcast where we're airing this conversation.
Yeah.
People will learn things. And it's interesting because I go around, as I say, I go around universities and I go to schools. And I speak to a lot of different people. I also sit in Westminster with politicians, but also leads in this area. And I learn a little bit. You learn something every day. And often when I go even to the schools, a lot of the things that the children and the parents are telling me, those are things you take away and you go, oh my gosh, I hadn't thought of it that way. But by sharing these things and having open conversations and by talking, I think it helps everyone kind of level up.
Yeah.
So you can have an experience yourself and learn from it, but you also can learn from other people's experiences.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. That's where the kind of lived experience and shared experience is very valuable, because we don't always have to walk through hell to understand that hell can be bad.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think that is really important. So, you know, people often go, oh, well, you know, we talk and we fix stigma, but, you know, we're making progress, but talking is a lot more than just breaking down barriers. It's also, you know, giving people the tools. They don't have to go to that place to learn that this might be, there's an alternative way.
Yeah.
To answer your question, can I say I won't struggle again? I don't think that's the case. I think there's always, with therapy, you kind of learn that certain things are often quite deeply ingrained. And when they come up as a thought or as an intrusive thought, or, you know, I might look in the mirror and go, Alex, I don't like that. You know, I don't like the way my stomach looks there. There's no point kind of berating that thought, because then you end up berating yourself. You kind of sit with that and think, well, actually, where does that come from? That comes from what I've been taught about what it means to look like to be a man. But then I've relearned these things and I understand that that doesn't equate to me being not masculine or not attractive. And then you depower that thought and it drops down again. So I would say that it's not that I'll never have times where I criticize myself. I'm pretty sure everyone in the room that's here now and people that are watching at home or listening at home, we all have hang-ups on our bodies. It's about not letting that becoming a dominant feature in our life, or, you know, becoming the way that we measure our own value. You know, your skin, your value is not about your skin or your body type. And regardless of whether your weight is high or your weight is low, depending on your situation, that's not about the value of who you are, is not in that. The value in you are what you like as a person, you know, your friend, what you like in your friends and family, how you treat people around you. Like, give yourself a bit more praise at times. Yeah. We're very quick to put ourselves down, aren't we?
We are. It's something that I was smiling quite a lot there, because it's something I've been writing. I've written a book, just launched, which is for girls age 9+. And there's a whole section.
Congratulations. It's so much work, isn't it, writing?
It is. But there's a whole section there, which is exactly about that, about how you can assess your own worth and how we do really overvalue appearance and body size. And, you know, we've grown up in a world that has taught us to do that, but actually we have the power to overcome it. And I think learning, the younger you are when you develop those sorts of tools, the better. I think you're in a really unique and special position, really, because what you describe there is you sort of go around the country meeting all these various different people from different backgrounds with different experiences, and you absorb all this information, and then you're like a sponge, and then you're almost able to repurpose it and put out that information in whatever way is necessary to help people. I think that's really special.
I feel very lucky that, in the sense, if you look at my situation, I have quite a big platform. I also am someone that I've experienced my own experiences in life. I've had my own, you know, loss in terms of my brother in suicide. I've also struggled with my own mental illness at times. If you combine that then with my ability to kind of go around, and I think I'm a good communicator, but communication, as we know, is actually listening is the biggest part of communication. Mm-hmm. You go around, you listen to all these people and you try and bring together, and as doctors, what we're good at really is we're good at looking at a broad amount of information and coming to certain conclusions. That's kind of what we do, is we summarize. Yeah. We're summarizers, aren't we? We kind of look at a presentation and we summarize, well, we think this might be the outcome, let's try this. And that's kind of generally, you know, what I do. And I've kind of picked certain areas. I mean, early intervention is very important to me. It's amazing you've written that book. I wrote A Better Day for Young People, to be, you know, emotional literacy, teaching about getting in early in life to ingrain the good habits, good ways of thinking, good processing, good self-care before we get ingrained, and perhaps not tarnished is the wrong word because that implies we can't get better, but before the kind of negative side starts to kick in properly. Yeah. I'm really passionate. You know, people often ask me, like, how old should you be to learn about thoughts and feelings? Well, if you're old enough to have thoughts and feelings, yeah. if you're having thoughts and feelings, yeah. you are old enough to learn about them and like Absolutely. Building blocks of emotional literacy, building blocks of understanding these things. And if you want to tackle things like toxic masculinity, well, educate then. Yeah. Let's educate. I'm very passionate about early intervention. And, you know, I think, you know, it's not, you know, I think sometimes we're negative. We're like, okay, I've grown up in that era where it was stigma and all that kind of stuff. You can relearn, you know, of course you can. There's yeah. processing, there's recognizing unhealthy views on ourselves and looking at ways we can break down a stigma and by relearning and retraining, we can get better. And, you know, therapy has helped me a lot for that. And also just self-reflection and stuff, just being able to sit with thoughts and, you know, learn to kind of package them and think, well, this is unhealthy, this is healthy and so on.
And by the way, that book was A Better Day.
A Better Day is my
And mine is book. You Grow Girl. Right. This might not even be real because I found this on Google, but I wanted to ask you, there was something in the papers about explain this scenario where you were in a queue. And somebody commented on your body. Did that actually happen?
Yeah, yeah. I remember because when I spoke about it, I put it on my Instagram, and actually the matron from Lewisham was a very close friend of mine still, Gail. She messaged me and said, I remember that day because I told her about it afterwards. And I said, this was awful. And basically, for context, so I worked in Lewisham Hospital up until about a year and a half ago, and I left the A&E department to go to the canteen, which I know if anyone knows, Lewisham Hospital is just kind of adjacent to where A&E is. And I was queuing up, and two girls came up to me. I don't know the exact ages, but they were kind of, you know, young adults, but in their 20s. And you know, one of them said something along the lines of, Dr. Alex. And I'm trying to remember which one it was, but one of them squeezed like the side, like the love handles almost.
Oh, I actually touched me.
Squeezed and said, oh, you've put on some weight since Love Island, laughed. But it was kind of, they laughed quite loud, but they said it quite loudly. And it was kind of like, so a lot of staff that were there heard it. It was kind of an area where there's patient staff and yeah. just by people that have been in there. And it was very much, you know, when people recognize you, there'll be other people that know, all right, it's Dr. Zoe, someone's gone up to them. They're kind of watching the scenario. They're just yeah. aware that yeah. someone's approached someone that they know is known. And so people
so
were just watching
it. You kind of do feel
it.
Like all eyes Everyone are kind on
of,
you.
Like, and it was, and I could feel that people were like, oh, that was out of order. But they were laughing, and it was a real, you know, because you're sometimes aware of things yourself. You're like, okay, fine, I am bigger than I was then. But it was not nice, you know. And I didn't eat for like 3 days after that because it really affected me. And I remember telling Gail after, I went back, obviously I left the queue and didn't eat that shift, which is not great. Well, actually for 3 days. But I went back and I told her, and she was like, that is just awful. But it's often, I think, for guys, it's seen as it's kind of like a fair game to take the mick
out of a guy's
weight.
You're allowed to do it. Yeah, I know what you mean. People might think you're more, you would never do that to a woman, but you might do it to, and I think also sometimes when you're in the public eye, people almost feel that permission and that you're public property.
And I think it's really important to say that I recognize that I think women have been subjected to this for much longer, and I think in a much, much different, probably more harmful way than men have. I think it is different. I think the body image expectations absolutely affect men, perhaps slightly in different ways, but definitely like it does affect men too. And that, you know, I'm a human like everyone else, and often you're picking on something that maybe I was dealing with at the time myself, in terms of I'm processing something, I'm working out where I'm at, and you know, maybe I have hang-ups, and you just basically pointed out something that was insecure to me. And you know, it was tough. But what I thought was really interesting though is that a lot of the papers immediately says Dr. Alex admits to overeating disorder, admits to eating disorder. And there's a few things that surprise me in that is that, and I've seen it many times, actually, not just with me, with others, but admits to is always used when it comes to mental health. Like, it's the same how we say, unfortunately, still say, committed suicide. Up to 1961, it was a crime to attempt to take your life. In fact, you'd be incarcerated for taking your own life. Doctors' certificates in the past for death certificates, families would say, please don't put suicide because it was committed suicide. You know, the word carries a huge amount of shame. You know, you commit a murder, you commit GBH. It's not a crime.
Yeah.
It's an illness. And you'd admit to a crime, wouldn't you? You wouldn't admit to an illness, but the words admit like Alex admits to medication for his mental health. If you look for anything where there's a relation to mental health in any way, the word admits is always, is it admitting? Are you admitting a wrongdoing?
Yeah.
And secondly,
it's like you would say like, he admitted that he stole the watch.
Yeah, he wouldn't say he admitted to a heart attack, would you? It'd be odd if you read a headline saying Alex George admitted to having a heart attack.
Admitted to having asthma.
Yeah, exactly. They wouldn't write it because it wouldn't read right. The reason it wouldn't read right, because you think, well, that's not admitting something. You've not done anything wrong. But interesting in that point as well is also that the papers, I think, and press need to be careful, because I have not been diagnosed with an eating disorder. I didn't say anywhere in what I'd written that I'd had an eating disorder. I was talking about being fat shamed, but I thought that was very interesting off the back of that. It really reminded me that. I was like, wow, you know, that the words you use are still really powerful.
So powerful.
And I feared I've from right at the top of government all the way through to people who work in right in the midst of the mental health field, committed suicide, the words still used. And I'd just encourage people, just be careful with those words. You know, I think we shouldn't be to the point where you can't use the word crazy, or like, you know, there's certain words in certain contexts that I don't think are harmful. Others might disagree, and that's absolutely fine. But there's certain things I would say, okay, there's the realms of like, I think we use that so widely, it has no association. But the words like committed suicide really do. And admitting to, they do have this so heavily laid. And or someone saying, oh, that person's a bit bipolar, for example. Very, very damaging and harmful. I think.
Or a bit OCD as well. That's one that you hear all the time.
Or a bit ADHD. And one of the things I always said is, look, don't worry, Alex, everyone's a bit ADHD. And it is so devalidating, removing validation, whatever the word is, from a whole group of people. And that's where you saw, you know, recent documentaries that have been done around ADHD. I think largely have caused quite a bit of damage, you know, because, you know, people in the ADHD community are saying, well, you know, we're made out to have like made this up, or we're kind of like soft diagnosis or something. And actually anyone who has ADHD can say that it is very, very difficult to deal with. And like, I've learned so much, I think, of my own mental health struggles in life of actually because I didn't understand how I was and that I had ADHD, that has really helped me in terms of finding my homeostasis, my kind of balance in life, is just understanding that I am different to other people.
Well, Alex, I can't let you go without asking one more question, and that is, what's next for you? What's going to happen in the future? What can we look forward
to? Well, it's been a few weeks since I published The Mind Manual, which is kind of, I guess, the book that I've written to try and help people understand themselves.
And that's for adults, isn't
it? Yeah, it's for adults. And, you know, if you think A Better Day was for children, building in those things positively before maybe we've learned bad habits, I think the Mind Manual is really about capturing what I wish we were taught at school, our own minds, about, you know, building resilience, self-care, and a bit of understanding about some of the options out there if you do need support. And otherwise, carrying on with the Stompcast. So that's my podcast. You must come on the Stompcast.
I'll hold you to it on here.
I'll go for a nice walk and stuff. And yeah, I'll keep advocating for mental health, try and get the government to fund these support hubs I've been asking for 3 years, fingers crossed.
Will we see you one day being Prime Minister?
No, I won't be Prime Minister. For many reasons, mainly that I wouldn't be, I don't think I'd be any good for that. I'm not sure that that'd be my skill set, but I'm just passionate about the advocate side, and I enjoy being able to follow my nose, if you like.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that personal stuff and all of your wisdom. And I think now's a perfect time to bring in our expert for this episode. Before we continue with this important conversation, here's a quick message from our sponsor, Bupa. An eating disorder is a mental health condition that affects your eating behaviours. Having an eating disorder can have a big impact on your life. You might have upsetting thoughts, feelings, or emotions that lead you to control what you eat as a means of coping. You might also have strong feelings about your weight or body shape, which affects the types of food you feel you can and can't eat. Eating disorders can start at any age, and they can affect people of all genders and cultures. Having an eating disorder can affect both your physical and mental well-being. It can have an impact on your health. Eating disorders are often hard to see because they're mental health conditions, but there are some physical symptoms and changes in behaviour to be aware of. Physical symptoms might include losing weight, feeling lightheaded, menstrual changes, or even chest pain. Changes in behaviour might also include a disrupted eating pattern, eating in secret, or avoiding food or eating occasions. There isn't one single cause or reason why you might develop an eating disorder, but eating disorders are often a way of coping with difficult emotions. With Bupa Health Insurance, you'll have support for almost every mental health condition, and you'll still be covered even if your condition comes back. Bupa doesn't cover you for conditions you have before taking out the policy, but you'll have reassurance for future conditions which may arise. Bupa's specialist mental health team can give advice, put you through to a mental health nurse, or may even be able to direct you to another mental health specialist. Search Bupa Mental Health for more information. Terms and conditions apply. Welcome back. We've now been joined by Dr. Helen Murphy, who's a consultant psychiatrist with a special interest in eating disorders. And I'd love to ask you, first of all, Helen, to let us know a little bit about your work in this area.
So I'm a psychiatrist, which means that I'm medically qualified, but specialise in diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders. So I went to medical school and I initially trained as an anaesthetist, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
I switched specialties to psychiatry and came to London to do my psychiatric training. And in the course of my training in adult psychiatry, I had the opportunity to work with a really great eating disorders team at St. George's in Southwest London, Professor Hubert Lacey. Just really grabbed my interest, really. So I did some of my training. And then when I became a consultant, I got a post in eating disorders at St. George's and just kind of went from there. So I've worked in the NHS in that service. And then I've also worked in private practice and specialising in eating disorders.
And obviously, you know, our conversation earlier on, we talked about mental health more generally, but we did hone in a little bit on eating disorders. And also, I think the conversation around body image as well.
Yes.
And I just wondered what your thoughts were on our conversation, any reflections you had, any thoughts
you had. So one of the things that struck me was what you said, Alex, about young people saying that they don't feel heard and they don't feel seen. And I think that's something that patients, that people who come and see me say a lot. Mm. And it can be a particular issue, I think, when they try to get help. And unfortunately, the way that a lot of services are set up, they really are set up to treat people who are very underweight. Mm. And so sometimes people will go and seek treatment and they'll be told, you're not low weight enough, you don't meet the mm-hmm. criteria. And of course, what they will then do often is go away and lose weight.
Yeah.
So that's a really unfortunate thing. It's to do with resources, really.
Yeah.
I saw, I did a Children Need documentary, Our Young Mental Health Crisis, and there was a young girl called Rosie who spoke on the documentary, and she was told that, and she went away and did exactly that. And it was just really, it was so sad hearing that story. Really, it takes me back to that room now, actually, where we had the conversation where you're kind of like, wow, imagine, you know, being a young person speaking to this person to be put in front and then said, actually, you know, it's tough. And I think it's so hard on everyone in the mental health service, as well as those working obviously in CAMHS and the eating disorder services, because everyone's trying to do their best. People mm-hmm. want to help people, but there has to be the resources as well.
Yes.
Yes,
you know, it has to be. It can't be run on the goodwill of people all the time, can it?
That's so true. Yeah. Mm. And so when resources are scarce, people are excluded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've spoken a little bit about the importance of early intervention. I mean, we were talking about early intervention, sort of giving people the tools prior to there being issues. Yes. But here, what we're talking about really is
getting in there early with treatment.
Getting in there early when the patient's asking for help to be turned away. But also, I think it's just lighting up in my brain that conversation we had earlier on where it goes back to medical school and our training that we're taught mm-hmm. that this is what an eating disorder looks like.
Yes.
And it's a person who's usually female, who's usually a high achiever, who's very underweight. And that's in society, that's not what eating disorders always look like.
And actually, when I started out in my training, I was told that 10% of people with eating disorders are male. And now we recognise that they're much more common in men and that actually the rates in men are about half to a third what they are in women.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, yes, there is an imbalance.
That was in my mind, the one in 10.
Yeah, there is an imbalance and mm-hmm. it is more common in females, but the proportions are way different.
And I wonder, because it beats to quite a lot of work around to beat
the charity.
They do quite a lot of work in this, especially amongst looking at men. And I just wonder, do you think it's part of it is men coming forward, or maybe even men identifying that perhaps that they have that? Because you think of the kind of, like in Wales, I look around a lot of my friends, or even my behaviours around training and exercise. I need to look like, oh, I'm not a man unless I look like this. I would never have thought that was an eating disorder.
Yeah. Because
obviously I was a young person at that time. Yeah. I wouldn't have even thought that was a possibility. Yes.
I think
because it's a social norm, right? That's
definitely everywhere I grew up, it was not like it was normal.
I think there are probably many things at play, but I think there's increased recognition and men are more likely to feel able to come forward. But there's probably also an increase in incidence in men.
One thing I would really like to ask you, as a GP, I know that as GPs, we are not good at dealing with eating disorders, mm-hmm. identifying, diagnosing. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the issue is, what do we do? Because we know that actually for those people who do have, you know, who have severe, you know, severely underweight, we can refer them. There are specialist services, yes. but we know actually that for the majority of people that maybe come to us asking for help with an issue, beyond IAPT, which is, you know, the CBT, sometimes counselling that they can access, which often they'll have, you know, been through that already. Mm. What should we do?
I think there are lots of, so BEAT is a great charity.
Yeah.
Has lots of resources for parents and for sufferers, including a helpline and support groups and workshops. So you can direct people to that. On the website too, there are lots of books and resources that you can direct people towards. For example, there are some really great CBT self-help books for binge eating problems that really take people through a kind of understanding and then a stepwise approach to how to tackle it. And I don't think it's a substitute for, you know, for treatment for a lot of people, but it's a starting point.
It's something.
Yeah. What do you think, I'm just as I'm listening, what do you think part of this, it's very big, it's probably another podcast episode, but what do you think part of the solution is in terms of, is there a way that we can perhaps support people better? Is the funding, does the funding need to go into different places? Clearly we want more funding globally in mental health.
I think it's a really difficult one, isn't it? But I think schools perhaps have a role to play. So training for teachers in recognition or and in, I think in schools there could be a lot more education around, you know, in PHSE lessons, for example, around body image and media literacy and talking about emotions and managing feelings. You know, I've heard some great things like primary school where mindfulness was part of the curriculum.
Yeah, and there's, I don't know, I've visited so many schools around the country and certain schools that have done so much. I think what's interesting is you see disparity between some schools that have really got an incredible infrastructure. They have the kind of whole school approach of health and well-being. They think about emotional literacy from a young age. They do work around body image and things like that, and masculinity and femininity and these things as they grow up. But then other schools don't have anything at all.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So unless it's made part of the actual curriculum.
Wales has changed to a four-purpose approach where well-being sits in parity with the other like academic pillars of learning, which means that essentially the way schools are assessed and funded are different. And we're already seeing in Wales quite a shift. And I hope that in England they'll do similar things, because it feels like building stuff in so that we can prevent a lot of people
early on
having it, then also having that support and intervention. Because I think that's what I've heard a lot from young people. It's kind of like when they have the support and they're there with the services, they often receive amazing care, but it's often that in between.
It's that gap, isn't it?
It's the gap. And I think, the worst bit is hearing, obviously, that, all right, your weight isn't low enough. And I've sat down many times with Claire Murdoch, who's the head of mental health in terms of NHS England. And, you know, she said, like, it's not supposed to be like that. But we know that in reality, you know, sometimes as you said, the resources are so scarce, you've got to make decisions.
Yeah. The resources are scarce, it's got to go somewhere. And this is what we always see, I think, with lots of other conditions. You can't not support those who are at the very extreme end. That's, you know, you can't not help those people. Those people desperately need our help, but so does everybody else. Yeah. But you can't remove resources from there.
No, because anorexia, it has a high mortality. Yeah. You know, so you've got to intervene.
Isn't it one of the most dangerous? Yes. Is it the most dangerous mental health condition?
Well, it's got the highest mortality of any mental illness. And of course, it's quite young people who would otherwise be very healthy.
Helen, can you define the difference for us between an eating disorder and disordered eating?
Well, I think it is a bit of a spectrum, really. But for an eating disorder to be kind of clinically diagnosed, I guess it has to be having quite an impact on the person's life and on their day-to-day function, as opposed to, you know, just a bit of disordered eating is quite common.
How can you recognize? I recognize in myself certain times where I'm like, okay, this is not going the direction I wanted to. What are the things that you could do? And I think especially as, maybe I'm talking as a man, but like as a guy, like how can you recognize the difference between training because you want to be healthy or eating a certain way and like, oh, actually this maybe isn't, there's something building here.
I think it's for women as well. It's when training for health and healthy eating become mental health problem.
I think it's when you're making it such a priority that it's eclipsing everything else. And I think for most people, they know when that's happening. So for example, if they're isolating themselves socially or, you know, they're shutting down, they're not communicating with people, they're being secretive about things, they're, you know, they know, you know, as opposed to, you know, taking healthy exercise and balancing it with other aspects of your life and, you know, eating regularly and eating what you need to nourish your body. Mm. It's very different from disordered eating.
Mm. Now, I think the final thing I really like for us to collectively, well, for you two to do actually, is for people listening to this podcast who either themselves are struggling or if it's the parents or relatives or loved ones, what can they do? What's the first step? Listening to this right now, as we end this podcast, what's the first thing they should do?
I think parents can try to have a conversation and not make it so much about food and looking for a solution, as you say, Alex, but about listening and saying something like, I've just been a bit worried about you. I'm just not sure you're that happy at the moment. Is there anything going on?
About the emotions rather than their behaviours. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't for a moment say the food side should be ignored because you can't recover from an eating disorder really without some, you know, if it's a severe eating disorder, you're going to have to have some focus on that.
But it's not the way to start the conversation.
No, you're going to hit a brick wall if you start a conversation about that.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I've heard as well, I guess. I mean, I think for support, I mean, Beat are amazing. I've done a lot of work with Beat. I think they're fantastic. As you said, they've got great resources about approaching conversations and stuff. Young Minds as well. I mean, they're not centered around eating disorders per se, but they have a lot of great communication leaflets and stuff. So again, like, how do you have a conversation about mental health? And, you know, I think a lot of it, the communication is the biggest thing. It's like the patient-doctor relationship, isn't it? The biggest barrier sometimes is that communication. Mm-hmm. If you can develop a good rapport and a good communication, a way of understanding, then that's half the battle.
And don't have the conversation at the table.
No.
At the meal table.
Mm. Yeah. I guess is that kind of creates, it makes it, the issues in the kitchen.
But then, these are the things that, you know, the Beat leaflets, etc. would tell you about. They give you pointers to how to start the conversation, where and when.
It's a great point because it's kind of like, it's one of those things again in life, is you know, the unknown. We talk about medicine, it's like, if you don't know, you don't know, but then when you learn, you're like, oh, that makes sense. So I think it's so helpful, those leaflets. Sometimes we think, oh, it's just a leaflet, no, but just honestly sit and read it, because often there's some really good pointers in there and you go, oh gosh, I didn't think of that, I'll try that.
And for people listening to this who themselves know in their heart of hearts that they're struggling, that they have an issue but they haven't shared it with anybody, how can these people, you know, they might want to tell somebody, but what are the words to let somebody know, whether that is a loved one, whether that is their GP, you know, how can, I think sometimes people struggle to find the words.
The only thing I would say is just please remember, like, that, you know, I've got a tattoo that says, this too shall pass. I'm a big believer of that, but it passes because, you know, you reach out and you get help and you get support. There's no shame in that. And,
absolutely.
You know, some of the strongest and most incredible people I've met have been through some of the most difficult things and had mental illness. Mm-hmm. And don't think for a second that you can't be an amazing contributor to society and your friends and family and have illness and be recovering from illness or going through illness. You know, it's, you know, you are a valuable person regardless of that. So, you know, please ask for help. Don't let things get worse.
This too shall pass. And I think on that note, I'll wrap us up. But Alex, thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Thank
you. And you can give me a few pointers because I'm just starting out. Helen, thank you so much for sharing
your
knowledge and expertise with us as well. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Zoe Williams, on The Doctor Will Hear You Now. For future episodes, to make sure that you're the first to know of their release, click follow wherever you're listening right now. Also, tell us if you liked it. Leave a rating or review or share with a friend. You can find me on Instagram at Dr. Zoe Williams, and I look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Insanity Group.
Thank you to our fantastic series sponsor, Bupa. Here's a quick message from them. An eating disorder is a mental health condition that affects your eating behaviours. Having an eating disorder can have a big impact on your life. You might have upsetting thoughts, feelings, or emotions that lead you to control what you eat as a means of coping. You might also have strong feelings about your weight or body shape, which affects the types of food you feel you can and can't eat. Eating disorders can start at any age, and they can affect people of all genders and cultures. Having an eating disorder can affect both your physical and mental well-being. It can have an impact on your health. Eating disorders are often hard to see because they're mental health conditions, but there are some physical symptoms and changes in behaviour to be aware of. Physical symptoms might include losing weight, feeling lightheaded, menstrual changes, or even chest pain. Changes in behaviour might also include a disrupted eating pattern, eating in secret, or avoiding food or eating occasions. There isn't one single cause or reason why you might develop an eating disorder, but eating disorders are often a way of coping with difficult emotions. With Bupa Health Insurance, you'll have support for almost every mental health condition, and you'll still be covered even if your condition comes back. Bupa doesn't cover you for conditions you have before taking out the policy, but you'll have reassurance for future conditions which may arise. Bupa's specialist mental health team can give advice, put you through to a mental health nurse, or may even be able to direct you to another mental health specialist. Search Bupa Mental Health for more information. Terms and conditions apply.